Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 116 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crow, that's crow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com. You can join the discussion and like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. Listen to us every Tuesday at 2 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time here on prn.fm, or download us after broadcast using iTunes or another podcast program. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, including your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor the show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information you are gleaning, for the support you get for some of your non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges you get to others. If you'd like me to speak at a meeting of an organization you're a member of, on science, on medicine, on viruses, on democracy, censorship, or other social issues, I'd be happy to discuss this with you. There was a little bit of feedback, a positive feedback, on the Charles Ortel discussion on the Clinton Foundation. Bill, via email, wrote, "Thank you for your interview with Charles Ortel today. It was good. You tried to challenge him, and you asked him good questions." Randolph, also via email, wrote, "Thank you for the excellent interview with Charles Ortel. In regards to your ending commentary, that a discredited former president's spouse can even be presented as a potential next presidential candidate. While a dark cloud of scandal follows the Clintons everywhere they were, and going back all the way to Arkansas, in their positions of trust in governance and lawyering, it's a very sad reality that Hillary so proudly boasts that she might be the first woman president. This puts to shame all the other decent and gifted women out there. Decency and honesty are not requisites for the office of presidency, obviously. Only corruption and a forked tongue can elevate you to the position of governing the United States. Please keep your hard-hitting interviews coming. Truth covered up. Not only do these illegalities affect the United States, they affect the well-being of the entire world." And that is certainly very true. The government of the United States has a big impact on the entire world. The question is whether whoever's the president makes a difference or not. And what do you do if you have two choices for president? And I understand technically there are more, but there's only two who could conceivably win. You have two choices, and you don't like either of those. What do you do? And now let's go to our guests. The subject this week is censorship. Today, I'm pleased to be with Joan Shenton again, and also Andy Reese. Together, they made the documentaries Positively False, Birth of a Heresy, and Positive Hell. Joan Shenton was a well-known medical documentary maker in the 1980s and 90s who got into trouble for critically examining the then-new HIV-AIDS dogma, particularly for questioning the safety, necessity, and effectiveness of the first AIDS drug, AZT, that came out in 1987 and was manufactured by British drug company Burroughs Wellcome, now part of GlaxoSmithKline. Andy Reese is a media producer, director, self-shooter, editor, and award-winning documentary maker. As a disclosure, I should note that Joan Shenton is a board member of Rethinking AIDS, and I am the president of that organization. I've also been involved in protesting the censorship of their film, Positive Hell, which we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the show, Joan and Andy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Andy, I'd like you to briefly describe the film Positive Hell. We've talked about it on the show before, but some of our listeners may not have listened to that episode, and Joan described it before, so perhaps you can give your take about what's this documentary all about.
Well, the documentary is an expose, essentially, of five individuals from San Diego in northern Spain, who, all of whom are ex-drug users. None of them are gay or homosexual, as far as I understand. And their story was in refusing 20, 25 years ago antiretroviral drugs when they had been quote unquote diagnosed HIV positive. They changed their lifestyles and to all intents and purpose have been fit and healthy ever since. And I think what Joan and I wanted to do, I mean, it was very interesting that, you know, Joan's mentioned this recently, but also on many occasions. But the whole coin of phrase HIV denialist is simply not true. It's just what Joan has been doing, has been questioning as a medical journalist over a number of decades, the hypothesis and also the treatment, importantly. And this film was nothing more than allowing five individuals a chance to tell their story. And their story and their situation, their history, their family lives, and their opinions are theirs. And all we did was allow them on camera to tell it.
Right. 20 to 25 years, being HIV positive, not taking drugs. And as you said, they were heroin addicts, I think, back in the 80s, but they quit the habit and they've tried to live healthy lives since then. And it's worked, whatever's worked. Has anybody tried to explain?
Can I just add a tiny point there? It's actually, thanks, Andy, because that was a really good description of what we're trying to do. It's 28 years when we filmed them, and now over 30.
Wow.
That they were tested HIV positive.
Yeah.
Now, you've been criticized. Obviously, we're going to talk about the censorship of this film. It's just happened a second time. But you've been criticized because this goes against medical wisdom, medical dogma. You know, everybody knows that HIV causes AIDS. Has anybody who's opposed to you tried to explain how these people can live in good health while being HIV positive for 30 years without AIDS drugs, if the HIV/AIDS dogma is true? Has anybody tried to give an alternative explanation?
No.
Good question.
No, they haven't. And I suppose, David, that's the reason why Joan and I have been aggrieved about these screenings that we've been banned in London, because one, in direct answer to your question, the answer is no. But also, you know, this is not an academic paper, nor is it anything to do with the medical profession. It's just an independent film. And, you know, if Joan and I could go make a film about the British National Party or the Nazis, it wouldn't mean that we're, Holocaust deniers. And that's the kind of label that we're getting. And, you know, freedom of speech is, as we know, very important. I think just before Joan talks a little bit, I think possibly what's more interesting about this is the film, as people can see on the website, has done a number of film festivals around the world, you know, in Spain. And as Joan said, we won a couple of small awards in Ohio last month. And yet it seems to be that we are accepted at a London Film Festival, being a British film.
Right.
And we're kind of, applauded by the festival. But I think on both occasions here in London lately, it has been rather obsessive lesbian and gay charities and individuals who have been...
LGBT.
The LGBT have been bullying the festivals, despite the festivals quite happy to schedule the film. And they've had to, the festivals have capitulated because of this bullying. And I mean, one, this is nothing to do with, this is not a gay story.
Right.
It just happens to be a story about HIV. Now, HIV, as we all know, is contextualized within impoverished Africans, etc., etc. And I think that's the most frustrating thing for us, that the festivals that we've been rejected and banned from in London have been bullied by an establishment who haven't seen the film, that's the first thing, and just simply don't appear to be able to offer anything than sort of whimsical a grievance, and yet no one seems to be able to actually come face to face and discuss the film, not necessarily the content matter of HIV, but the film with us.
Right, I can see, like, let's say that you decided that you were going to do a film on neo-Nazis in England, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody may say, you know, this is not really a film about neo-Nazis, it's neo-Nazi propaganda, and yes, it shouldn't be aired. But I would think that if I went to a film festival and said, you know, I think you're getting deluded by this filmmaker, he's actually a neo-Nazi, he's made this neo-Nazi film, wouldn't the film festival then take these concerns, if they thought they were at all serious, and go to the filmmaker and say, you know, can you respond to this? This guy's claiming that you're a closet neo-Nazi and this film is just propaganda. Can you respond? But were you asked by the film festivals to give your side of the complaints that were being made?
No, we on both occasions in London over the past few months, Joan and I were given absolutely no chance for the right of reply. We were just simply told that for whatever reason, the film was going to be banned and the festival's decision was finite. But again, David, it's a good example. I mean, maybe the neo-Nazis is a little extreme. If we take it sort of slightly subtler, it was my fault for not sort of presenting this. But I saw a film in Sheffield the other day about alternative therapies for various cancers.
Right.
And, you know, and as we all know, that there are many holistic and alternative ways. Does that mean that any of the filmmakers or any of the people, the participants of the film, are cancer denialists? I don't think they are. They're just simply looking from a personal perspective for an alternative way of dealing with what they may have, as opposed to chemo or radiotherapy, which, as we all know, is not good.
Yeah, and I think the point needs to be made, like, you were not making a documentary that said, you know, HIV doesn't cause AIDS, and then give some examples. You were basically telling the story. And if there's anything that approaches, quote, AIDS denialism, it's the comments of Dr. Manuel Garrido, he's very interesting because he's HIV positive. He was an alcoholic. Like the others, he turned his lifestyle around. But he's a medical doctor, right?
Precisely. So he's a medical doctor, and as Joan has said on many occasions, as a medical journalist, she is just the messenger passing on information. As a filmmaker, part of thing that excites me is to allow people with distant voices and possibly people who would never have the opportunity, that opportunity to tell their story. And so there was no propaganda within this at all.
Yeah, it's hard for me to see this being characterized as propaganda, where basically it's interviews where the people are talking about their lives, and it's very clear that they lived without AIDS drugs, even though they were HIV positive. And if there was anybody saying HIV doesn't cause AIDS within that group, it was the medical doctor amongst them, who himself was HIV positive. And of course, if he was wrong, then he was going to die because of his own advice, right? It's not like he was telling people to do something crazy and himself was safe. He was in the same situation.
Absolutely. And then two other participants in this film, one was diagnosed HIV positive and her husband was not. And they have a family. None of their children have been diagnosed HIV positive. Now,
Andy, let me just come in there. Her husband was positive, but it was considered a false positive. So he lost his HIV status. Then she gave birth to two young girls, babies, and they inherited the mother's maternal antibodies for HIV to HIV. recently, and they lost those maternal antibodies after 18 months.
Yes, Joan, Joan is absolutely right. I wasn't quite as specific. Right. The point I was trying to make is that that information, that content within the film, should be seen as a celebration and a, pardon the pun, a positive piece of information, as opposed to something that is questioning something else, simply because it's true, the antibodies disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really remarkable that, you know, the HIV AIDS establishment, all these AIDS charities, you know, they always try to put forward a positive spin, things are getting better, the drugs are better, people are living longer, blah, blah, blah. But if you come along and say, here's some people who didn't take the drugs and lived healthy lives for 20 years, instead of being really excited and saying, well, we should look at them, maybe it's a gene, maybe they took a special supplement, maybe there's some explanation for this, this makes us happy that some people avoided what other people got in terms of AIDS, but instead it's like, don't talk about it, go away, shut up. In this most recent case, which was the Portobello film festival, and I kind of know Portobello because there's like a famous market in Portobello.
I live on the corner of it.
Okay, so it's a local film festival. It's independent, and they got a call from a BuzzFeed reporter named, I think, Patrick Strudwick, whose Wikipedia page calls him the 11th most influential gay man in the UK. And within, according to something I read, I don't know if it was Strudwick himself, within 2 hours, they'd canceled the film without talking to you about it, and you actually heard about it through the media, I think.
Yeah, through BuzzFeed. I was rung up by Patrick Strudwick, who was very hostile, and I just couldn't believe it when he said, oh, you know, your film isn't being shown. So I said, well, why and who's done this? And I said, is it groups that receive funding from the pharmaceutical industry? And he said, no. And then, well, I still don't know who the two people were who telephoned Jonathan Barnett, the director of the festival, first, right? I don't know who they were, but then Strudwick rang. And later, when I spoke to Jonathan Barnett, he rang me. I said, have you pulled this film because you're afraid of losing your funding for the festival? And he said something like that.
And who's funding this festival?
Well, the
main sponsors are the Westway Trust. Now, that is a charity that is part funded by the Kensington and Chelsea a local authority. I've had a lot to do with the trust in the past. It used to be called the North Kensington Amenity Trust. And they are actually, it would appear, the only sponsors, because it says in big letters, sponsored by the Westway Trust. Okay?
Right.
So I fully intend to get in touch with them. I am guessing, but I would imagine if they were not in favor of showing the film, then Jonathan Barnett would have to comply.
Right.
Because he kept on saying, I want my festival to go on. I've done it for 21 years. I don't want it to put it in danger.
Right. And I mean, that's interesting, because in the case of the London Independent Film Festival, it also seems to be pretty much a one-man operation. In this case, Eric Schultz, who is a gay man, who was rung up by, I think, 3 AIDS charities who complained about the fact that your film was going to be shown. And as far as we can tell, Eric talked vaguely about having a committee of LGBT students at his institution, but we actually couldn't find an institution that he was associated with. So it appears that this is really a personal project, which is fine, but why is he so sensitive when he gets a couple of phone calls saying you shouldn't show this film?
Well, partly because Eric Schultz is also one of the most influential gay people in London when it comes to film. And secondly, it wasn't his decision. You know, what happened, BuzzFeed was involved as well, and Ben Goldacre, who's a medical journalist, quite famous.
Yes.
So there were a lot of people buzzing around in the background there, stopping... I've just confused two festivals. I'm thinking of Anne Sonneau, whose festival at SOAS was also pulled, and I was to be on her panel. That was when the BuzzFeed and Ben Goldacre's names came up. Mm. With Eric Schultz, it was, as you say, three AIDS charities.
Well, that's what he said. I mean, we don't know the names of those charities, and we actually wrote to a bunch of charities and said, did you ask for the film to be censored? And the ones who responded all said no. And so by a process of elimination, we thought maybe the Terence Higgins Trust, which is maybe the biggest AIDS charity in the UK, was behind it, but we don't really know that.
Stop AIDS.
Yeah.
Is another one, which involves many, many students on campuses. And the whole issue of no platforming and safe spaces, you see, has grown from students' unions and students' campuses. And most of them, and many, are dominated by the LGBT groups.
What does no platforming mean? It's not a term I'm really terribly familiar with in North America, at least. Safe spaces, I understand, but explain no platforming.
Means the students' unions say they refuse to invite anybody that might cause distress to the students. And the phrase distress was used, you know, about our film.
Might cause distress. I mean, I think one area that's maybe a little bit similar in terms of no platforming, although it's a two-sided area, which is more, you know, it's kind of interesting, is the Israeli-Palestinian thing. There are people who are very strongly supportive of the state of Israel and see all Palestinians as terrorists. And then there are people who are strongly supportive of Palestinian rights and see the Israeli government and the Israeli Defense Forces as terrorists. And I can see that in a university that's dominated by one side or another, they wouldn't want to let the other side have a platform. But that's pretty clear censorship, in my opinion. And why would universities be a place where there's debates about what should be censored?
Absolutely. That's it.
I mean, Joan.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I did a film a few years ago in between the two films that I've done with Joan about the Croatian homeland war of the early 90s, which was a real David Goliath, to use a biblical reference, between the Croatian army and the Serbian army. And it was undeniably sympathetic to the Croatian point of view. It was a sort of retrospective film. And yet we showed it in Vukovar, which is a town that was bombed to smithereens in Croatia, where now, 25 years later, Croats and Serbs live together. And they saw it as an historical piece. They saw it as a retrospective. And there was debate and discussion about what happened, but the film was a retrospective from one person's side, and that's what created the debate. And this is exactly the same thing. It's just retrospective. It's people telling their stories.
Patrick Sturdwick just in the last couple of days published an article where he documented, I think, the lives of four people with an HIV diagnosis who claimed that drugs had made a big difference in their lives. But I mean, I'd love to have a discussion about that, because you could also make the argument based on the stories that drugs destroyed the lives of these people. They were in many cases suffering side effects, but there were explanations given in the article, such as they started drugs too late. It was the early drugs weren't as good as the drugs they have now. But clearly it was not a clear case of they were dying, they took drugs, they got better. But it appears like we can't have that discussion, because if you were to say, isn't this story, these stories you've written about, aren't they also compatible with drugs making people's health worse? I don't think we could have that discussion.
Well,
sorry.
Drugs, you mean antiretroviral drugs?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the thing is, we shouldn't forget that even the doctors we work with agree that some of the new antiretroviral drugs, protease inhibitors, have an anti-inflammatory, antibacterial, an antimycotic capacity, so they can damp things down.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe some people's condition is ameliorated by them for a while. But as you said, David, the long-term side effects are enormous. And the trouble is that doctors don't want to take them off them because they think if they take them off them, the virus will get them in the end. Yes. So they're put on them for life.
Yes.
I mean, I also think in specific reference to this film and the participants of this film, off camera, two of them said, another reason we chose not to to do drugs was because that's the very thing that we'd been doing for such a long time, and we just didn't want anything to do with drugs.
Right.
Which again is just a personal perspective, and they're entitled to that.
Right at the beginning, you said these people we interviewed changed their lifestyle. This is a key point that, as David said, we have not been allowed to debate. That if they change their lifestyle and stopped injecting toxic substances straight into their veins three times a day, as Raquel used to when she was 17, of course her antibodies would race, and of course she would test positive to HIV, but she stopped the drugs. She stopped the heroin.
Yeah,
I think this is where, you know, there are accusations of homophobia, because in the early days, there were basically two theories about AIDS, or gay-related immune deficiency, as it was called in 1981. One was that it was caused by drug use, particularly paupers, and the other was that it was caused by a sexually transmitted virus. So gay men either were, you know, HIV either showed the gay men who were getting AIDS as either promiscuous or as drug users, and it sort of became seen as an attack on the quote gay lifestyle, even though most gay men were not using drugs to the excessive level that the ones who got sick were, just as there's a huge variation in the amount of promiscuity from none to a huge amount in the gay community. So, you know, the gay community kind of allowed themselves to be tarred as highly promiscuous when that's not true for all gay men.
Correct.
Can you think of other examples of films being censored by film festivals outside of the context of HIV and AIDS?
No, I think probably the ones to do with BNP and Holocaust denialism. Probably, if we look back in the history, there will be films that have been censored.
I guess Vaxxed, I should have mentioned that. That's the film on vaccines, and that was withdrawn from a New York film festival under quite similar circumstances.
Yeah.
And again, it seems to have had something to do with funding, or even the very existence of the film festival was threatened by people.
But as I understand it, with that particular film, and it was a big film festival that it was banned from. The film festival were in touch with the filmmakers before any of this hit the main media. And I think Joan and I, you know, we have an issue in terms of that. We simply weren't given the right to respond.
Yeah, it seems only fair that if you know, you're accused of endangering public health, that the film festival organizers would write down the reasons that are given, and then they'd say, "Can you respond to these? Because we can't show it if these accusations are true." But there should be some opportunity for you to respond.
Yes, of course. Of course there should be.
And in the past, Joan, prior to Positive Hell, you mentioned a film by Ansono, a German filmmaker, which also was similar in the sense that it talked about the lives of several women who had declined or stopped AIDS drugs. And that was going to be shown in London. That also was censored. Can you describe that?
Yes, at the School of Oriental and African Studies, SOAS, right?
Yes.
and a group called Women for Women International booked the hall, and Anne was going to show her film, and several of us were going to be on the panel for a discussion. And on that very afternoon, I turned up, and Anne was sitting on a bench weeping, saying not only was the film cancelled, but her Women for Women International had disappeared because they'd had pressure put on them by the Students' Union, who said no way could this film be shown, and so they had disappeared. So we demanded to speak to the principal at SOAS, and the deputy principal came down, and I said, do you have the power to reinstate this screening? And he said, no. Well, I mean, I'm sort of, you know, simplifying the situation, but the fact is that if the Students' Union, which is a limited company, right, within the university, right, if they are asked for a hall to be booked, and then the people who booked the hall withdraw, which was Women for Women International, there's nothing the principal can do, who's the academic principal, to reinstate the screening.
And Joan, if I can just add to that, bringing it back to the Portobello and the London International Independent Film Festival, I mean, we were selected.
Yeah.
And we were, and as far as the film festival were concerned, as the festival director Jonathan Barnett said, he saw nothing untoward about the film. You know, it has to be understood that they have hundreds of submissions, and we paid for that submission. So by definition, we'd actually paid for their screen time.
Right.
Yeah, but
they
returned that money.
Well, yes, they have. They have now. But the point is, they didn't give us any chance, despite us actually having paid. They didn't give us any chance to respond prior to them.
This is like being on a no-fly list, right? Like your name gets on the list, you have no appeal. Yes. You show up at the airport, and it's like, no, you can't fly. And it's like, why? We don't know.
It's totally guilty before proven innocent.
Yes.
I think what Joan and I now, you know, in the aftermath of this, because it's happened before, I think Joan and I would really like Patrick Strudwick from BuzzFeed and maybe someone from Terence Higgins Trust and Jonathan Barnett, the festival director, and maybe Eric from the London Independent Film Festival, to be able to sit down and explain to us, and let's have a healthy debate about this.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, there's nothing saying that if your film had been screened, that everybody in the audience had to mindlessly absorb what was in the film and accept it. I mean,
I want to come in there because I was there and I saw the audience. And as soon as they were told the film wasn't going to be shown, and they were mainly young people, young couples, actually, and I had 5 minutes in which I tried to describe the stories of the five protagonists. They demanded to know why the film wasn't being shown. They demanded, and they were furious.
Yes. Well, I can imagine, because maybe they wanted to be challenged. Maybe they're thinking, you know, I've always believed in my life this was impossible, that if you didn't take AIDS drugs, you were going to die, and this story seems incredible. I want to see, and maybe there's flaws, and at the end of it, I'm going to say, you know, you're not right because of such and such, or maybe my mind will be changed. I mean, isn't that why you go to a film festival, is to have your ideas challenged a little bit?
Precisely. And you know, David, I mean, Joan and I have been working on these two films for the past 6 years, and obviously you talk about it, et cetera, et cetera. And without a shadow of a doubt, every single person I've mentioned Positive Hell to have wanted to see the film, to allow themselves the opportunity to judge, enthuse, ridicule, or whatever. Without exception, they've wanted to see the film. And festivals should adhere to that, and they should respect that. And that's precisely what a film festival, an independent film festival, should be all about.
Well, it's a little bit like comedy, right? Like, if you are a comic, I mean, some comics never offend anybody, but a lot of comics offend people, right? And if you basically say, you can be as funny as you want, but you can never offend anybody, then you know, most comics would be put out of business.
Well, you know, it's quite interesting you mentioned that, because I was going to bring that up. I have a comedian friend of mine who's just finished at the Edinburgh Festival, who knows about this subject matter, and we were chatting about what to do, and he said, if I created a half an hour set based upon the film or the subject matter, would it be ridiculed and banned? And he said it might be ridiculed, but it certainly wouldn't be banned.
Yes. What is the influence? It seems like money is sort of behind a lot of this. We have AIDS charities who get money from the government. They may get money from foundations, and they seem angry that this film is going to be found, be shown. We have film festivals that are dependent on not the receipts from the box office, but funding from other organizations. And the gay community probably gets a lot of money because AIDS is seen as a challenge mostly for the gay community. So a lot of money flows into the gay leadership in order to combat HIV/AIDS.
But surely, what a wonderful opportunity it would have been for Patrick Strudwick to have been able to sit down in the cinema, actually watch the film, which as far as I know, he hasn't done, and then, you know, go to town with it.
Oh, he probably has, Andy. I'd like to come in on that point, because I know, David, you're familiar with this argument, but what has happened is that, unlike the towns where we showed our film in Spain and where it got awards in America and it was shown at LA Cinefest and all these things, London has an extremely rich hierarchy of gay leaders, and they receive a great deal of money from the pharmaceutical industry. So what happens is they want to suppress anything that might lead the wider community to question whether or not it is they who are endangering the lives of their own and others.
Yeah, but Joan, the nature of this particular film is it's passive. It's not aggressive. It's not trying to persuade anyone. It's simply putting a camera and a microphone in front of someone's face.
Let's not beat around the bush. I mean, I've made 11 documentaries on this subject and written a book about it. Of course, I am associated with those people who question the HIV/AIDS hypothesis. Not you necessarily, but me. Now, I'm trying to think of another parallel, like the gun lobby. You know, if a journalist who has written many articles about the gun lobby and opposing it should make a documentary highlighting the dangers of those who support the gun lobby, do you think their film would be censored?
Well, none of Michael Moore's films have been censored.
No, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, the closest thing I can think of is that the Republicans in Congress did at one point pass a law that prevented the Centers for Disease Control from studying gun deaths.
But the Edward Snowden film, Citizen Four, wasn't censored by the U.S. government. None of the films about Julian Assange have been censored.
No, it's all to do with money.
But, you know, the gun lobby is all about money too. There's something special about medical issues, like you know, Vaxxed and Positive Hell and Ann Sono's films are all contradicting medical quote wisdom unquote. And that seems to be a line that you cannot cross, that you have to accept medical wisdom, despite the fact that if you study medical history, you know, most of the things that were being done in the 1940s or 50s or 60s are no longer done. A lot of things that were done back then are now considered dangerous and not supported by evidence. And I think it's pretty clear that 10, 20, 30 years from now, a lot of things that medical establishment does will be considered wrong at that point. But today, we can't question them. But how do you move forwards on some of these issues if everything you try to say is stifled?
Well, that's That's the very point that Joan and I are trying to make with what's happened in London over the past 3 or 4 months.
I'd like to talk more about the role of Patrick Strudwick. Did you get the sense, Joan, that he'd actually been pushing for the censorship of the film, or was he just acting as a journalist and recording this interesting event that was occurring?
Definitely he was pushing, because he kind of said, oh, two people had rung beforehand, but that it was after his, that he had called and he'd been categorically told it was going to be withdrawn. And it's difficult for me to explain, but he was so hostile and so rude to me, that I actually dreaded whatever he would write in his piece. But at least his piece had a semblance of balance in it in BuzzFeed.
He's in the past, he acted as an activist journalist on the issue of gay conversion therapy, and I don't know if everybody knows what that is, but basically there's some people, psychologists or doctors or whoever, say that basically being gay is a disease and they can cure you of this through, you know, aversion therapy or whatever it is. And he did a big expose on that, and it resulted in some changes in medical practice in the United Kingdom. So I think he's probably right on that issue, and I think the science is probably behind him on that issue. So there's nothing wrong with being a journalist slash activist.
Absolutely.
But on this case, I certainly don't agree that the science is clear. But I got the feeling he was quite proud that he'd been able to assist in the censorship of this film.
Of this film, yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
But I don't know him, so I have no idea.
I guess the question is, if somebody did a film on gay conversion therapy, and or let's say somebody did a film on people who had one time thought they were gay and eventually decided they were heterosexual.
I know that there are many like that, and I know people who know them, who actually wanted a family and to get married and did go and have a few sessions of counseling. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, there's a lot the other way around. People who've been married for 10, 20 years who eventually say, I'm not heterosexual. I'm going to divorce my husband or wife, and I'm going to live my true self. I guess that's freedom. Yes. But I guess the question is, if you did a film where you talked about one side or the other, people who said in their 20s that they were gay and then in their 30s said they were straight or vice versa, would that be banned?
Well, it would depend a bit, but I mean, that's point in fact. It depends on the way you're making the film. If you're making the film which is highly persuaded from a journalistic or filmmaker's perspective, then possibly. But again, this was not. It was just simply allowing five people to voice their opinions on camera. There was no coercion, there was no persuasion, there was no manipulation, there was nothing that we asked them to do, there was nothing within the editing that could have been seen as coercive or persuasive.
No, and their stories were very moving.
Yeah,
very.
They were.
Yeah, I mean, I would be interested in listening to people who'd changed their sexuality through their life. I think that would be interesting. I don't think I have an opinion, and also I don't think that I would necessarily think that everybody has to follow the same path.
Absolutely.
But it would be interesting to hear why people changed their minds, you know, the turmoil they went through, whether they went from gay to straight or vice versa. I think that's kind of interesting, and it would help people learn about what is sexuality and how fluid it is.
But what you've moved away from the central issue, which is who would be allowed to make that film? What track record do they have that would allow them to be screened?
Yeah.
I mean, I can see that something like that being banned, just because, even if you're just telling people stories, just because it would make some people uncomfortable. And yet, you know, people who are politically correct are supposed to make people in power uncomfortable, but it seems when they're made uncomfortable, we're not allowed to to do that?
Well, no, because it's fashionable now to have safe spaces and no platforming.
Right. Was there a time in the United Kingdom when the gay media were censored and banned? Films, books, whatever.
Oh, I'd like to go to Stonewall and ask them, because I'm sure there was.
A long time ago.
Oh, like, yeah.
Probably not that long ago, the 60s, 70s, maybe?
Yeah.
Where, I mean, at the time of Stonewall, there were, in America, there were raids on gay outlets, whether they were gay media or gay clubs or whatever. And I think there was a big case in Canada where there was a bookstore called Little Sisters, which had a lot of gay erotica or pornography, depending on how you want to characterize it. And there was a big suit against the Canadian government that kept seizing packages of books that were being shipped to them. It seems ironic that the gay media that sort of suffered suppression, and censorship is part of that suppression, is now participating in censorship itself.
So that is a very strong point.
I think there's a little ignorance of history. I think this all started when you sent out a press release. So some people would say, well, you were just taunting people who believe the HIV/AIDS theory. Maybe you shouldn't have sent out the press release. What's your response to that?
I've worked for television all my life, for different broadcasters. You always send out a press release before you transmit a film. In the old days, it was broadcast, transmission day. And now, with us, it's screening date.
Right.
This case, what on earth would be the point of putting out a press release after the event?
Right. I mean, would it impact the number of people who would show up, or like if you didn't do any publicity for your film, like what would be the impact of that?
Huge, press coverage.
Yeah.
The point about a press release is to tell, and a press release goes out to 500 or 800 people in Britain and around the world, all the gay press, all the media, all the newspapers, and it tells them that this is happening so that they write about it.
Right, even if it's a hostile article. I mean, I guess film critics, when they get a press release, they don't have to like what's in the press release, and they can go and write something terrible about the film if they want.
Of course.
Yeah.
But you probably wouldn't have much of an audience if you didn't have any publicity at all.
No.
What impact will your experiences with censorship of Positive Hell and your other experiences, what impact are they going to have on your filmmaking in the future?
Well, I just want to say that I am really keen to take this further, to index on censorship and to pen, P-E-N, and ask for legal advice about where we stand on censorship.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to make another film, maybe on another topic, would this change how you would approach making a film?
No,
of course not.
No.
Okay, is there anything else that you would like to add on this issue of the censorship of Positive Hell?
Well, I think. Sorry, Joan. Joan did some interviews with London Live, a local television channel, and she has been given some airtime, albeit the most recent one really quite hostile. But I think at the very least, we should be able to suggest to them that they possibly screen broadcast the program, and we have a panel. Studio panel discussion.
That would be nice. I remember one time when I was invited in my hometown of Calgary to an interview on the local university student-run radio station. They brought in somebody from an AIDS charity to, you know, counter what I was going to say, and the man refused to sit where he could see me. So they had to have him and me in two different studios while we were being interviewed at the same time, which was like the most bizarre situation I can think of.
Yeah.
Joan, would you like to add anything?
No, I think that we've had a really stimulating discussion. Thank you, David, for your questions. Yep. And I've said all I can say.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to be, I guess I'm an activist journalist. I just am offended by the censorship. And I think from my point of view, well, let me bring up Charlie Hebdo. We can't talk about censorship without Charlie Hebdo. There was a big earthquake in Italy recently, and they put out a cartoon that showed, they called it like Italian lasagna, and it showed a layer of buildings and some legs sticking out, and then another layer of buildings and then the legs sticking out, and they characterized this as lasagna. It was the most disgusting image I've seen in a long time.
Yeah.
And yet I think they have the right to publish that, even though it's really offensive.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's not like they're trying to make some important point. It's just a cheap laugh, I think. I mean, I think it's terrible humor. And yet, if we're going to have a world where we can have discussions, we have to let stuff like that, which I don't think has any redeeming value, get published. And yet here, I think you were making a very serious point, just documenting people's lives, the contradict science, and it's banned because people who maybe are making a lot of money off the whole HIV/AIDS hypothesis are upset.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you for joining me today, Andy and Joan. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, David.
Thank you, David.
Okay, goodbye to both of you, and thanks to my audience to listening.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks.
Censorship, just like the censorship of the movie, the documentary Positive Hell, is at the center of a lot of modern political disputes, especially those involving things like safe spaces. In my town of Calgary, there was a dispute that went viral. Here's an article from the Daily Mail of London talking about a small university in Calgary. It was a male student, Matt Linder, who was approached by another student, a woman, Zoe Slusar, and told to remove the hat, which was a pro-Donald Trump hat saying, "Make America Great Again." As far as I could see, that's all the hat said, "Make America Great Again." Slusar shouted, "You're not allowed to share hate language at a university." She continued, "Make America Great Again means make America great for all white people, no immigrants, no people of different sexual orientations. You've got to take the hat off, or I'm going to write to the president of the university. It's not allowed. It's hate language on campus." The man wearing the hat, Linder, is seen shaking his head and disagreeing with Slusser, and this goes on with a lot of people getting involved in the verbal shouting match. And eventually somebody grabs his hat and runs away, which was kind of an appropriate juvenile end to the whole thing. Slusar later wrote on Facebook, a post on Facebook, I'll quote a little bit of it. "Today I got into an altercation with a guy wearing a Make America Great Again hat. I went up and asked him," actually she didn't ask him, she told him, "if he would take the hat off, explaining that the university should be a safe space." Actually, she was essentially threatening him with expulsion by threatening to get the president of the university involved. She continues, "I stand by my belief that every space, but especially university spaces, should be made to make everyone feel safe. We need to equally support and express movements and gestures of inclusive acceptance. But what about accepting people who support Donald Trump or support similar right-wing views? Although I think it's probably true that there's a lot of racists and misogynists who support Donald Trump, but there's also a lot of other people who don't support Hillary Clinton for lots of other reasons and see Trump as the only alternative. It's true, for example, that Trump's the only major candidate who's made any comments against universal vaccination. And so if that's a big issue for you, you might support Donald Trump. and ignore some of the other things that he has said and some of his supporters have said. Slusar continues, "There are some warriors who are not too tired, some humans who want anyone being attacked to know they are equally being supported. I'm ready to make some noise, Calgary. Be a warrior and express your support for those who are attacked every day because of who they are." And then she ends with a hashtag peace. I don't think she understood the irony of using war metaphors and her own aggressive verbal attack. Well, it's not a physical attack, verbal attack on a man who was wearing a hat expressing presumably his political views. The university said very little, except they supported freedom of expression. So I guess the hat can stay, except it disappeared. So it looks like Matt Linder may need to buy another one. And while I'm most definitely not a Trump supporter, I definitely support the right of Matt Linder to wear a hat. An Alberta commentator who's very progressive wrote in support of the woman Zoe Slusar, and I said I thought that the whole thing made her look ridiculous. And he said, well, what about somebody wearing a swastika or a KKK hat? Well, let's take the swastika. In Asia, the swastika has a completely different meaning. Admittedly, it's the reverse image of what we normally think of the swastika. So it really depends on the context. What if you were making fun of neo-Nazis by wearing the swastika? What if you were making fun of the KKK by wearing the hat? I understand that if you showed up, a bunch of people showed up at a university which had maybe a number of black students wearing KKK, that would be seen as very threatening. But I really don't see a hat that says Make America Great Again in anywhere the same realm as a KKK uniform. I do agree that universities should be safe spaces, physically safe spaces. I think students should be protected from violence. I guess that's true just about anywhere. That's why I don't support the carrying of guns on campus. I think especially in a environment where there's many young and immature people, and there's also a lot of alcohol and drugs being used, guns are very dangerous. However, if we make universities safe from views that you don't like, then they're not really universities anymore. I don't understand how you can get an education under those circumstances. After the video of the event went viral, I think if there'd been no video, this never would have been such a big deal. Zoe Slusar said that hundreds of people have been calling her parents home. They've been calling early in the morning, leaving hateful messages such as she's told to kill herself. Somebody said that they hoped she was raped by all the black people she's helping. And somebody else said they'd come to the hospital after she was raped to suffocate her. Clearly, this is completely out of line. Zoe had the right to express her views. She went around in a very clumsy way and just made herself a laughingstock. But really, she didn't do anything that remotely warrants messages like this. And I really think if we're going to have a discussion, we all need to calm down and try to listen to the other person. Like, she could have started by saying, don't you think this hat that you're wearing supports racism and white supremacist, judging by the people hanging around Donald Trump with those viewpoints? She could have started a discussion. Thank you for listening to episode 116 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.